This is the Berkeley Signal.
This one is the original rhythm alongside General Bani Huno said, don't believe the media. Don't believe the media. Well, this one's dedicated to all the freedom fighters all around the world. People of Euskadi, people of Irlanda, people of Cuba. Don't believe the media. Rudem alongside General Bani say, we'll be right back.
We begin today's show with an update on a major development that could be the path to freedom for former Black Panther Mumia Abu-Jamal, the award-winning journalist who was convicted of the 1981 murder of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner, but has always maintained his innocence. On Thursday, a Philadelphia Common Pleas Court judge ruled Mumia Abu-Jamal can re-argue his appeal in the case before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court because then-Chief Justice Ronald Castile failed to excuse himself from the case due to his prior role as Philadelphia District Attorney when Abu-Jamal was appealing his case. Abu-Jamal's lawyers argued that statements Castile made about people accused of killing police officers indicated he should have recused himself. They cited campaign speeches and letters he wrote that called for the death penalty in such cases. Abu-Jamal spent nearly three decades on death row before his sentence in the shooting death of Officer Daniel Faulkner was thrown out over flawed jury instructions. Prosecutors then agreed in 2011 to a sentence of life without parole. Judge Tucker's decision on Thursday was split because he denied Abu-Jamal's claim that Castile had, quote, personal significant involvement in the case while he was in the district attorney's office. For more, we're joined here in New York by Johanna Fernandez, a professor of history at Baruch College, CUNY, the City University of New York, and one of the coordinators of the campaign to bring Mumia home. She has been in the courtroom for part of this case and is the editor of Writing on the Wall, Selected Prison Writings of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Professor Fernandez, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you talk about the significance of Thursday's ruling?
This is a case that is important for Mumia Abu-Jamal, but also for dozens of people sitting in prison in Pennsylvania. Essentially, the judge established that if there is prejudice in a hearing, the defendant has the right to a new hearing. And he essentially ruled broadly on the issue of judicial bias and impartiality in the courtroom. That's really important because the Williams issue, which is the issue that Mumia and his attorneys presented, is very narrow. It essentially establishes that in order to get relief, you have to prove to the court that a prosecutor turned judge had previously been involved in a significant decision in the case. That's a very narrow issue to prove. The judge stepped back and he said, well, we cannot prove that there was a significant involvement in a major decision in the case because the DA's office lost the files. However, it is very clear that this judge made comments in public that were improper, that he lobbied on the issue of law and order. In fact, he ran on this issue. He made statements about sending, quote, a clear and dramatic message to, quote, unquote, cop killers that the death penalty will be used against them. All of these things, including the fact that this judge received funding from the Fraternal Order of Police, the same organization that in the 1990s was hell-bent on executing Mumia, that essentially paints a clear picture of partiality.
So talk about what exactly this means.
So this means that if the liberal DA of Philadelphia, someone who was elected on the issue of the horrors of the criminal justice system in Philadelphia, if he does not challenge the judge's decision, Mumia will immediately be eligible to present all of the violations that he had previously presented before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And those violations are many. They include the fact that Terry Moore Carter, a court stenographer, overheard the judge in this case, Judge Albert Sabo, saying, quote, I'm going to help them fry the nigger. It also includes another violation that essentially the police tampered with evidence and manufactured evidence in order to obtain a conviction in Mumia's case. It also includes the violation that the prosecutor hid evidence from the defense and from the jury. Essentially, there was a fourth person at the crime scene, and the presence of that person at trial was suppressed by the prosecutor, Joe McGill. So these and many other violations that essentially violated Mumia's constitutional rights were denied by Judge Ron Castile when Mumia presented these violations on appeal. Because there was an impropriety in the conduct of Judge Castile, because he was prejudiced, now Mumia is able to present all of those violations again. His case can be heard once again, and the violations connected to his conviction will be heard in court. This has not happened in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. The courts have not allowed Mumia to really challenge in a significant way any of the violations connected to his conviction. They've only allowed his attorneys to essentially address the issues concerning his sentence.
So the question is, will the district attorney now, Larry Krasner, who's considered this new generation of district attorneys around the country, has represented many groups from Black Lives Matter to others as a lawyer, would he appeal, number one, what he's considering now? And if there was a trial, would he prosecute Mumia Abu-Jamal?
Well, I think that the judge, Leon Tucker, essentially presented a case that will be very difficult for Larry Krasner to challenge. He essentially said, in order for the criminal justice system to stand, justice must be completely just. Those were his words. And it's very clear in this case and in this issue of judicial bias that there was a no justice, that there was impartiality. And so there's going to be an enormous amount of pressure on Larry Krasner by the Fraternal Order of Police to challenge this decision. But at some point, the people of Philadelphia have to stand up and have to demand that Krasner do the right thing in this case, that he not uphold what is known as the Mumia exception, that judges and courts have been willing to overturn precedent in order to keep the facts in Mumia's case from seeing the light of day.
In October, the widow of Philadelphia officer Daniel Faulkner was ordered removed from the courtroom after she protested the judge's decision to extend Mumia Abu-Jamal's appeal hearing. The Philadelphia Inquirer reported Maureen Faulkner stood up and cried out to the judge, "With all due respect, Your Honor, I have another 30 days that I have to go through this pain and suffering," she said. As she was ordered removed, she said, "38 years, this is wrong." The judge said the court was sensitive to both sides but wasn't going to rush to judgment and added, quote, "No matter how long it takes, the court is going to do the right thing." Were you in the courtroom in October?
I was. It was a very dramatic moment in the history of this case. It was an important moment because for the first time, a judge essentially said that the supporters, but also the family of Mumia Abu-Jamal, has a right to have this issue treated fairly in the case. That hadn't really happened before. At the very last hearing, we had another very dramatic development. The Fraternal Order of Police, Maureen Faulkner, and the original prosecutor in the case, Joe McGill, were present. And they were allowed into the courtroom before anyone else. And when we were finally allowed in the courtroom, including Mumia Abu-Jamal's brother, Keith Cook, who served in the military in the United States, the courtroom was filled with white people. And it was a completely Jim Crow seating. Essentially, Mumia's supporters, the majority of whom are black and brown, including his family members, were forced to sit in the back of the courtroom. So this is really the atmosphere and the message that the Philadelphia establishment sent to the judge, that he should essentially be careful about the decision he was about to make. But the judge, in fact, ruled in favor of justice. And we are demanding that Larry Krasner live up to that standard, the standard that he promised the people of Philadelphia. A city that is known for imprisoning the majority of black and brown youth in the country. So Philadelphia is the city that imprisons the majority of black and brown youth. This is the city that has also imprisoned and attempted to silence the most important political prisoner in the history of the United States, essentially the Nelson Mandela of our time. So if there's a victory in this case, in the case of a man who's been demonized for essentially illuminating the truth about black oppression, about the predations of capitalism and imperialism, a man who is mild-mannered but is unwilling to compromise with justice, this is the reason why he's been demonized by the police. If there is a victory in this case, the entire apparatus of criminal justice in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania and the country will be under the microscope.
I wanted to go back to 2013 when Democracy Now! Spoke to Mumia Abu-Jamal in a rare live interview from the prison he was in at the time, Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Manoy. This was after an appeals court upheld his conviction in 2011 but vacated his death sentence. He had been on death row for decades. I asked Mumia Abu-Jamal what it means to no longer be on death row.
Well, I could, but I'd be lying, because I call this slow death row. Life in Pennsylvania means life. Pennsylvania has one of the largest life populations of any state in the United States. It had the distinction of having the absolute highest number of juvenile lifers of any state in the United States, indeed of any jurisdiction in the world. So that should give you some sense.
So that is Mumia Abu-Jamal speaking in 2013. He no longer faces the death penalty. Life without parole is what he faces now in general population. What about his health, Professor Fernandez?
Well, about 2 or 3 years ago, Mumia collapsed in prison and was rushed to the hospital. He was near death. After 6 months of medical tests, one of our doctors who randomly went in and looked at Mumia essentially established that he had hepatitis C. As you know, hepatitis C is a deadly disease that affects the liver. But because treating hepatitis C and curing it costs approximately $100,000, the Pennsylvania prisons essentially decided that they would not treat Mumia or the approximately 7,000 other prisoners with hepatitis C. We filed a suit, even though attorneys insisted that this was an uphill battle and we would not win. And we secured a victory and we secured treatment of hepatitis C. Mumia is now cured of hepatitis C, but also this was a precedent-setting ruling that has opened up the possibility for prisoners in Pennsylvania and across the country to get treated and cured of hepatitis C. Mumia is doing better. He is back to health. He's got many issues. Currently, he has a problem with his sight. He has glaucoma, and he has to get the best treatment, as do other prisoners. And so part of what Mumia said is that life in prison is essentially a sentence of death for him and for the thousands of other prisoners in Pennsylvania and around the country.
Not to justify that of you and I. holding daggers up and letting you decide after passing information that's falsified. Stand behind a lie, what does it cost to die? What does it cost to live? Why do they specify these terms of why when they ain't the most high? What they fear they will kill, but the soul will never die.
Freedom is that cold road seldom traveled by the multitude. We need to dig through this gravel so we can cultivate this food. Motivate a few of you fools, regenerate the mood. Free ourselves from mental bondage, free ourselves from family feuds. And follow me through this prophecy, building our colonies where our pillars and columns be bigger than the Colosseum. I call them like I see them. The devil does the devil dance. Now they wanna murder Mumia. Take action, it's the only
somebody
chance.
Somebody scream bloody murder, bloody murder inside of my head. The executioner's clock controlled by the feds. They want Mumia dead. This nation of savages been trying to kill us for years. Somebody scream bloody murder inside of my head. The executioner's clock controlled by the feds. Take a legal action. They want Mumia dead. This nation of savages been trying to kill us for years.
In the holy month of Ramadan, doing down one degrees. Within the means of God's speed, feel the supreme penalties. Black nonfiction remains the weapon of choice. Reject the illusion of justice, and why is the black voice? The passion behind the veil, the flesh behind the bars, the spirit in front the force, who's deaf and who's cause? Break the black man down in front the black fam and all. Guilty as you all, free Mumia,
I plan to move my motherfuckers to the front line, ready with guns cocking. We storm the prisons, get the wards rocking. Snipe all the FBI and cops clocking. Officials' bodies dropping, offends the 85 bombing. Eye for an eye, we'll hang them by the Capitol steps. Snap the neck, snatch the vest, equip my children with text. Peep from protective feds, calling murder, legal execution shit. Free the righteous, I face the bloody revolution.
See, the Capitol folks got nervous, cause he refused to be their servant. Cause he spit truth that shook heads and burned like black churches. Prose and verses, filled with a million black curses. Watch, see, decision of Dred Scott as it reverses. So long as they rope is tied around Mumia's neck, let there be no rich white life, we bound to respect. Cause and effect, can't you smell the smoke in the breeze? My panther, my brother, we are at war until you're free.
Somebody scream bloody murder, bloody murder inside of my head. The executioner's clock controlled by the feds. Take illegal action, they want Mumia dead. This nation of savages been trying to kill us for years. Somebody scream bloody murder inside of my head. Controlled by the feds. Take a legal action. They want Mumia dead. This nation's savages been trying to kill us for years.
What he said was so clear, so true, that I had to stop everything and concentrate on his message.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
Imagine that you are out to dinner with some friends and your phone buzzes, then it buzzes again. And when you finally give up your social graces to find out what's going on, you discover a small army of anonymous jerks has just dedicated themselves to destroying you and everyone they can find who's associated with you. That is exactly the situation that Zoe Quinn found herself in at the outset of what's now called Gamergate, a campaign that threw a spotlight on the shady world of online abuse and that seemed to come into its own with the election of Trump. Zoe Quinn is an independent game developer. Her new book is Crash Override: How Gamergate Nearly Destroyed My Life and How We Can Win the Fight Against Online Hate. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
I'm sorry to drag you through this, but we have to do the exposition before we can get to the insights.
Of course.
Can you start the story? This was a campaign by an abusive ex.
Yeah, I dated this guy on again, off again, mostly off again for about 5 months. And when I had finally completely gotten away from this abusive relationship for a little while, he decided when he couldn't control me himself anymore to more or less crowdsource his abuse. And he created this extremely long, weird manifesto of half-truths and personal details and weird stuff he's just completely made up that he workshopped with a lot of people the same way you might workshop like a viral marketing campaign, except instead of like trying to sell something, it was trying to ruin my life. And he posted it in the places that had reputations for going after women before, especially women in games, hoping that would go viral. And after a few of them took it down for even being so far over the line for them, it caught fire on anonymous message boards. And I actually didn't even even see the post initially. I just was seeing the reaction to it and the immediate like deluge of threats and really disgusting comments, and just seeing people talking about how they needed to basically burn me in effigy because I was coming to destroy video games, basically.
You're not the first person who's had a crazy ex write awful things about you.
No.
I think the big question is why there was an audience for this particular diatribe, like why it mobilized people.
Well, the thing is, and this is something that I think a lot of people miss, is that it's not necessarily specific to games so much as there has always been this background anti anybody who's considered the other sentiment online. And usually the further you get from looking like a 1950s sitcom dad, the more you're considered like different or other. And gaming especially had this problem with women who are developers, and especially game developers who made experimental work. Like, I don't make the Call of Duties or the Marios of the world. I make games about feelings and farts, and I do comedy and stuff about mental health and other weird niche stuff like that. So it was very easy for people to sort of see me as being different and then project all of this internalized hatred or fear or anxiety onto me and like attack me as a symbol of everything they were afraid of, or of, you know, different people entering games and the internet, or even just public life in general, because this is by no means a phenomenon limited to games.
Part of your ex's polemic that seemed to catch fire in that community was a part that accused you of sleeping with a game reviewer.
Yes, which in order for that whole thing to have been true, I would have needed to like go back in time, sleep with a game reviewer to get him to write a review that never existed of my free game, and then erase any evidence that this had ever happened from the internet somehow to profit off of something you can't pay money for.
Right. So the buttons it's pressing is she's not actually a successful game developer. She is using her witch-like lady powers to create an ethical conflict of interest for a reviewer that is actually getting her the fame that she didn't have the skills to get on her own.
Right, which is hilarious when you consider that I had already written for the outlet that the reviewer worked for, so clearly I needed the connections, and that I'm not the person that would have committed the ethical violation in that case. I am not a games journalist at all, so the fact that they were later trying to use a dog whistle of, oh, we just care about ethics in games journalism, and then didn't go after journalists. They just focused exclusively on women and people of color and people who stood up for people who were not straight, white, cisgendered men in the industry. It seems awfully suspicious, especially considering a lot of those folks were actually pushing for ethical reforms in our industry, whether it was like labor reform, because the games industry does have a lot of labor issues, or talking about the uncomfortable relationship that gun manufacturers have with certain video game developers. So it's like people were actually doing that work about these ethical concerns, and they were also usually not straight, white, cisgendered men, and were targeted by this campaign that was pretending to be about something else. Like, it's remarkable how we didn't have the fake news term back then, but there was so much disinformation and smokescreening of what was actually going on to sort of make the abuse seem palatable or like a shame, but, you know, totally tangential to these supposedly legitimate concerns. So, you know, it was a way for people to gain this like false sense of legitimacy. And we saw a lot of early games press doing this like two sides. Well, one group says it's about abuse, but another group says it's about ethics. So who can really tell what's going on here? And it's like, I don't know, you could look at literally anything.
So I think we've kind of set the table, but we need to establish the stakes.
Right.
So what was the first thing you saw? What was the first indication this was happening?
I started getting a lot of weird Twitter notifications. The first one I can remember was somebody saying they carry a bottle of disinfectant in case they ever run into me at a conference because I'm so nasty that they would want to sleep with me and didn't offer me a free review. That's the first one I can remember. I think that particular user went on a lot of different tangents that were along those lines. I had a lot of people asking me for blowjobs right off the bat and being like, hey, you know, I've got a games blog, you know, you want a good review of one of your games and stuff like that. It escalated so quickly. Like overnight, people were changing my Wikipedia page to say my time of death was soon. And when that got reverted, it would immediately change to like the date of my next scheduled public appearance. People are already trying to find out where my father lived, where anybody that had any real or imagined connection to me might live. My best known game is rooted in the fact that I have depression. What they could do to isolate me from anybody who's ever supported me and get me to kill myself.
Wow.
And that was like the first 6 hours.
You started monitoring the chat rooms where this was being organized?
Pretty much immediately, yeah.
What were people telling themselves there? about what they were doing.
I think the thing that people usually miss with weird campaigns like this is people totally think they're the good guy. It's interesting. It was like a lot of people who did not seem to have any sense of community elsewhere that finally had like friends and something to do. It was just the thing to do together and find that sense of community in was finding and attacking people. There's a lot of power tripping on like, okay, how can we be able to manipulate this person's life as much as possible from behind a computer screen? Like what systems that the internet uses to function can we game here to cause the maximum amount of damage to her life? And a lot of people coordinating like these detective efforts of like, okay, well, we found this game developer that supported her. This is their wife's information. We should contact her. And like, here's the other family members. And which celebrity can we like bombard with tweets about this to get them to tweet about it? And oh, let's make some videos and try to get that to go viral. Like, let's really burn her to the ground, because they were really fixated on San Francisco being part of the problem. They're like, oh, this Bay Area cancer of these liberal SJW social justice warriors coming to ruin everything and bring censorship and try to make everything gay and bad. Like, we got to just burn them in effigy and finally get them out of gaming. And then that rapidly overlapped with what we're now calling the alt-right communities, like the men's rights activist groups that aren't actually into men's rights so much as they are into try to make it legal to hit women. Stormfront got involved super quickly, and a specific Breitbart.
That's an actual Nazi website.
Yes, that's literal Nazis. They got involved super quickly because people were trying to figure out if I was Jewish or not. A lot of anti-trans groups because they were trying to figure out if I was trans or not. Like, it was just whatever, this giant anti-progressive or different person bias, like all these different communities founded on that, like we're sort of working together against myself and a number of other people, marginalized people in games.
What was the worst thing that happened to you during that period?
Probably just having to deal with the ex, because like that's the thing, is like as much as this like spun into this giant campaign that infected so many people and led to weird stuff happening with the alt-right, like it's still for me rooted in domestic violence that I was trying to get away from. So the fact that I will never be able to get away from my ex-boyfriend now, his stuff is out there forever. It's been 3 years and I still get threatened and stalked and harassed constantly. And I probably always will be, because I've met people who've been targeted by campaigns like this that have been going on for more than 10 years and their children are now being targeted. Like, that's the worst thing, is I will never get him out of my life.
Presumably, he knew exactly what genie he was letting out of the bottle.
Yeah, he actually posted a lot of screenshots of him workshopping it with friends to ensure the maximum potential damage. And he would say like, oh, harassment is bad, but also I think she slept with this person and this person. You should do this. You should edit these videos. Let me do this like little media tour with like Holocaust deniers and all these other nasty people and feed more information to them. But then say harassment is bad just so, you know, to try to cover myself there.
Did you fear that the online threats would actually translate into physical violence?
Yeah, absolutely. After they found out what my home address was, I was getting pictures of my address sent to me. People were talking about going and finding my dad. There were people that have yelled at me in public. I have to be careful with what I even say about this sort of thing, just because I am so hyper-surveilled by these groups that if I say anything that I can't back up paperwork-wise and triplicate, then, you know, I might be getting myself into trouble, or someone might make like another call to action against me saying that I'm making stuff up or whatever. But there have been offline confrontations, just I can't document that so easily.
The first big question you kind of addressed, why do these people care? It's because they find some meaning in hatred. But you also talk in the book about there being an economy around this.
Oh, absolutely.
There are financial incentives in the internet. Mm-hmm. For people to be abusive thugs. How do they work?
Look at Alex Jones. He's been doing this for God knows how long. If you have a YouTube channel, you can monetize that with ads. That's like, you know, kind of in flux right now because they're trying to figure out what to do with that. And they've ended up, I think, incidentally making it so that LGBTQ creators can't monetize. So you get these people that sort of are performatively doing this sort of 2 minutes hate conspiracy theory weird stuff of like validating people who have like ignorant biases against certain groups or certain types of people, or like misinformation, or, you know, basically feeding into like the darkest parts of humanity. They're doing 2 minutes hates and saying, look at this person and how bad they are. Also, please like, fave, and subscribe. And also, here's where you can buy merch, and here's where you can support me on these like platforms like Kickstarter. So like aside from ad revenue, there's like this direct marketing that goes on. You know, these people are constantly cranking out new content and looking for new targets and looking for new quote unquote controversies and drama, when what might be considered drama is, hey, look, a trans person is alive and doing anything, standing standing around being a human. We don't like those people, so let's like all talk about how terrible they are and try to like mess with them. After I had gone through so much of this stuff and started an organization to help people who were in my situation, I was building connections with tech platforms to get assistance for people who would come to me for help and like be like, hey, change me your terms of service. Tell me what you definitely want off your platform. If someone comes to me for help and I know that's something you want to take action on, give me a contact so you can quickly remove it instead of going through this like backlogged, like overburdened reporting system that's slow, right? So I was trying to do this with WordPress. Their head of policy or someone in a position like that, I forget, while I was like trying to establish this escalation channel, I was like, yeah, so you know my ex's blog is still hosted like with you guys, right? He's like, yeah, it's a real shame about that. Like, you know, it doesn't really violate any of our policies. We have a pretty staunch free speech thing going on and, you know, it's not like harassment. I'm like, actually, there's like a criminal case for harassment pending in Massachusetts against him. The state of Massachusetts completely disagrees with you. And he's like, oh, well, I don't know. And it just kind of got left at that. And I had to just kind of smile and take that because I needed that contact to help other people.
That is a common argument among internet platforms is that they don't want to start playing the role of censor.
Oh, but they do. Look at what happens if you upload anything that's an IP infringement, or look at spam. Like, we've had all of these conversations already about spam in the 1990s because people would be like, oh, I have a free speech right to advertise my product however I see fit. I'm not breaking any laws. I'm not doing anything wrong. And that is like far more actually protected speech than something like a death threat. Eventually, like, it was this long argument, and what ended up happening is platforms were like, okay, well, we are not the government. We can't actually censor you. So,
meaning if they censor you, it's not a First Amendment violation.
Exactly. But we do still care about free speech. But the thing is, spam is impeding the intended function of this platform and making the experience poorer for everybody and is a quality issue. So we're going to regulate it. And now anti-spam stuff is a $1 billion industry. So that's honestly the attitude I take with this.
But there's no pro-spam lobby like standing up, waving the victim card,
right,
and saying the titans of Silicon Valley are cracking down on us because we're not politically correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They were back in the 90s. Like, that was a whole thing way back in the day. And that's the thing that's wild is, like, our collective memory for internet culture is so short because there's so much that happens in the density of information, and that is kind of wild, and archiving becomes kind of a nightmare. But we've been through this before. Ultimately, that's what it comes down to me is, like, hey, did you build this platform so that Nazis could harass a bunch of people? Like, was that your intended use case? If no, then maybe there's a problem if that's happening en masse. To pick on Twitter here, the fact that they have a little thing in their back end that says, more or less, it's the "is this account a Nazi account" flag. Then it doesn't show that account in Germany or France because there's legal repercussions for that, but no further action is taken. And I've seen plenty of times where, like, a Nazi is telling somebody, oh, we're going to put you in an oven or whatever, and this, the person responds, like, back being like, F you, and then the person who said F you is suspended and not the Nazi for anything. So it's like, if nothing else, like, if you're going to have terms of service that are anti-harassment, actually enforce them, or like say we're not doing that. Like, we actually don't care about this. This is not a thing we're touching. It's this like half measure BS about pretending to care that is the thing that really drives me nuts.
Right. Is that like a question, do you think, of the culture of the companies or kind of the economic imperatives? Tech companies make their money by automating things. Enforcement is a human task.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a combination of both because, you know, there's definitely a lot of good people working in these sort of broken systems that want to actually make their platforms better. But if you go high enough up in the chain of command, usually someone sucks or is like too risk averse to do anything. And there is definitely this like large vein of people who are very isolated, who aren't usually people targeted by harassment, that can not think about it and push it off as someone else's problem, that I think it's very easy to ignore and not empathize with fully. But that aside, yeah, it's like at the end of the day, the internet runs fundamentally on an economy of attention. And it doesn't matter if that is attention paid to something that is like a cool thing someone made, like a good song or whatever, or a call to arms against like a person of color for having the audacity to exist. Because like at the end of the day, traffic is traffic, and making numbers go up looks good to your shareholders. It looks like growth. You're going to be hard pressed to find people that are willing to cut into that growth for any reason, much less one that will get them yelled at. So it's like that combined with the fact that there is another huge streak of being like, oh, we can just make algorithms solve all of our problems. And it's like, that is absolutely not the case, especially when it comes to issues like harassment, because there's just some stuff that you cannot fully, like, you need context for. You do need to actually hire people to look at. And, you know, that was like something that was almost better handled in early days of the internet with internet forums. There were always moderators deputized from the community that helped clean things up. What I'd like to see is like some more resources being dedicated towards building these sort of community growth and basically tending the gardens that were growing in the first place instead of just throwing it all at advertisers and stuff like that. Like, it needs to be prioritized more than it has been.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
Gary Peoples, censorship and intellectual colonialism over the news. Statement by the Aboriginal News Group on internet censorship. Censorship is never over for those who have experienced it. It is a brand on the imagination that affects the individual who has suffered it forever. Professor Noam Chomsky. Under the guise of defending democracy, we have seen many questionable things transpire that cast reasonable doubt about the veracity of that laudable ideal. Today's international news reportage rarely reflects the day-to-day realities of often what is being done in the name of Western democracy. The links between functioning democracies and the rights and obligations of an informed citizenry are habitually talked about but rarely practiced. And because of this, the public is finding it increasingly difficult to separate accurate news information from spurious misinformation. This is not by mistake. The corporate information media has always downplayed or unfairly demonised progressive movements and causes, while negative, usually right-wing and conservative issues are accorded sympathetic, regular and respectful attention. This is why we state here, with all due respect, that if the good people who run the back end of Google's Blogspot are going to censor the front page of the APNS editorial blog Indigenous Opinion, we would really appreciate it if we and our readers were told why. If Blogspot is not behind the problem, then we would really like it if they said that too. We have no problems with discussing any issues they may have with international news and editorial material made available there, although we do wonder out loud what we could possibly post that could be even remotely be regarded as offensive. Especially in consideration of the fact that there are multitudes of websites that openly promote racist, bigoted, misogynist, and simply useless diatribes focused on little more than partisan negativity without being censored at all. One can find thousands of negative pages devoted to everything that we, in the West, vociferously claim not to support. However, it is very clear that only the left-leaning internet seems to suffer from the pains of isolation and censorship, not the right wing. The elements of intellectual disorder we really should be calling the objectionable rabble are hailed as the populist voices of the people, while progressive news and analysis is more often than not unjustly labelled as radical, and therefore outside of social consideration. We are living in a strange new world where rational and civil grassroots discourse is seen as suspect simply because it challenges the perceptions promoted by those that literally own the world. We, at the Aboriginal Press News Service and Aboriginal News Group, are not fools. We understand full well that despite the bellyaching of the right-wing pundits in mainstream media and talk radio, they are never marginalised. And any objective review of how the right-wing Tea Party was gingerly treated by both media and law enforcement, as opposed to how brusquely the occupied protests are being handled now, makes this point clear. In the new normal of 2012, this sort of Orwellian newspeak is condescendingly defined as a balance in media and free democratic speech in action, instead of what it really is, ugly, anti-democratic and anti-American citizenship. Any reasonable person would, when presented with the facts, ask why bloggers, journalists and websites that promote Indigenous, Aboriginal, First Nation issues and concerns, human rights and non-violence, multicultural and political understanding, conflict resolution, food security and safety issues, the right to be free from religion, First Nations dignity, international world peace, as we do, could be routinely subjected to harassment, surveillance and intimidation, while other projects that invoke and advocate negative communication, cultural misunderstandings and socio-political ignorance are free to ply the nefarious trade unheeded. This is a fair question. How can Western governments, conservative pundits and establishment intellectuals demand that the rest of the world make allowances for free speech, fair elections, religious freedoms and representative democracy, while humble and unfunded grassroots projects like ours are marginalised for making sure that our people, Indigenous peoples, are just as intellectually informed about the goings-on of the first, second and third worlds as anyone else? We have the right to be informed about how the world around us works, and as our lives and our very survival as people depend upon it. And that is the sole goal of the ANG and its official newswire, the APNS. We struggle for nothing here but the end of Indigenous ignorance, nothing else. We are a stateless, non-partisan news organisation staffed by uncompensated volunteer editorial representatives in several countries. We refuse to accept monetary donations, advertising or swag. We make the best use of all the web has to offer, and we promote the use of open source and freeware resources so that our people, Indigenous people and other poverty-stricken and oppressed populations may empower themselves and be a contributing dynamic within the information highway. Google's Blogspot helps the ANG do this and has done so since October 2004, and we are extremely grateful for their assistance and support over the years in giving our newsgroup a cost-free publishing platform that has gone on to inspire many others to become active in promoting Aboriginal First Nation news and analysis to those interested in learning about us, our struggles and our concerns. We believe that democracies cannot exist only in name. The free association of authentic news information is the bedrock of a free society. Indigenous peoples have the right to be informed about the political issues that have influence over our lives, our communities and our well-being. We do what we do because the mainstream media does not make an effort to acknowledge us and our concerns. And we find it extremely distressing that either Blogspot or a thoughtless anti-democratic hacker has decided for themselves what particular news or opinion information should be made available to our people. Being treated as if we do not have the right to be heard as human beings and as Indigenous peoples is offensive. Further, it goes on to demonstrate our collective editorial and community belief that the colonial societies that claim total dominion over our various and respective peoples and nations around the fourth world are indeed consciously working against us. We are without question, in every country where we reside on this earth, marginalised, targeted, abused, insulted and economically and culturally exploited in every way possible. This is a fact of life for us every single day of our existence. And what's worse is that we're expected to say thank you for the chauvinism with a smile and a sundance. Is it not enough that we have lost our lands? Is it not enough that we have lost numerous generations to racist violence and genocide so that the First World could enrich itself on our wealth? Is it not enough that our people, sick, sad and broken from more than five centuries, are being told that we do not exist? Just how much is enough? Just how much more must the Aboriginal and First Nations peoples around the world be degraded, ignored and told to shut up, stop complaining and stop caring about ourselves before the First World can feel secure in its powers over us? We are constantly told to pick ourselves up with our own bootstraps. Yet when we try to educate ourselves or make any serious attempt to be as intellectually independent as our betters tell us we must be, we are rudely forced right back into the mental servitude that they implore we must rise above. This is grand hypocrisy. And in truth, it is clear that there are those who have the power and the influence to shape the information and world right now, for whatever reason, we are in their bad graces. Perhaps we're exposing something that they would rather the First Nation peoples and other POCs not know or think about. We do not know. And it is equally clear that there are elements within the US ownership society that strongly wish for the Indigenous peoples of the world to be as ignorant as humanely possible about what is being done to our people, our communities and our natural resources. Whatever the reason, the ANG is proud to stand with the peoples of the Fourth World and a new generation of independent citizen journalists who report on Indigenous struggles and other news issues surrounding human rights, social justice and the right to free thought and speech. Don't censor our news, opinions or journalists from keeping the information flowing to the Fourth World. It really makes us think that you don't like us for who and what we are. An argument we should not need to make in a post-MLK world. The Aboriginal News Group, ANG.
Internet radio for smarter than original.
Yeah. no belief. Their belief sees me taken. No blue prize paid.
Children's book, Goodnight Moon, by Margaret Wise Brown, has delighted generations of children and parents. But 10 years ago, authors Eric Origen and Gan Golan parodied the George W. Bush administration in children's book form called Goodnight Bush. Now, we should perhaps not be surprised that the pair has published a new parody in the same vein called Goodnight Trump. In December, a group of activists gathered at the Trump Tower in New York for a guerrilla book reading of Goodnight Trump, while a visibly angry Eric Trump stood by and looked on. Gan Golan now joins me. He is a New York Times bestselling author, artist, and agitator. His earlier books include Goodnight Bush, as well as the graphic novel about the economic crisis, The Adventures of Unemployed Man. He now joins me to discuss Goodnight Trump. Welcome to the program, Gan.
Hi, Sonali. Pleasure to be here.
So I should say welcome back. It's been many years. We've had you on about your earlier books. Goodnight Trump. Should it have taken this long to put this book out?
Well, we certainly were not planning on creating a sequel, but we also were not planning on having another incompetent man baby as our president. So here we are.
And in fact, wasn't Goodnight Bush released quite a long time into the Bush tenure, whereas it's taken less than 2 years into the Trump tenure for this version of the Trump book?
Yes. The first book was really a lament for us to grieve and heal at the end of 8 long years of the Bush administration. This one is coming much sooner because it's really a call to action for us to rise up and remove this administration from office.
Instead of asking you to read us from the book, I want to play a video clip of the guerrilla action that I mentioned of this book being read inside the Trump Tower by a group of activists so that people can get a taste of some of the words in the book. Here is that action.
Good night, Trump. In the very classy room, there was a golden mirror and a silver spoon and a broadcast of a half-baked story from a fake newsroom.
And there were billionaires sending thoughts and prayers and a pair of manly mittens and 2 grabbable kittens, a big beautiful wall and a Russian nesting doll.
A golden seat for tweets in a rush. And a pretty young bunny whom money has hushed. Good night, classy room. Good night, heirloom clan costume. Good night, cowards kissing up to a buffoon.
Good night, bizarre handshake. Good night, ketchup on a steak. Good night, torches for hate crimes. And good night, fine people on both sides. Good night, cabinet of whack jobs. Good night, White House run like a mob. Good night, drilling in national parks. And good night, seven sins check marks. Good night, undermined law of the land. And good night, gutted healthcare plan.
Gan, tell us about this particular action.
Well, it was, of course, a sort of secret action, and we began broadcasting on Facebook without telling anyone where we were headed. But we just felt that because it was the holidays and in the spirit of giving, that we really should have, you know, sort of as a gift to Trump, have a little bit of a story time right in the belly of the beast. So we had a bit of a flash mob of people who's kind of secretly infiltrated Trump Tower. And then, you know, once we got past security, gathered at, right at the perfect moment to read it to everyone who was there. And of course, Eric Trump was kind of standing on the balcony, glowering at us the entire time as security was also trying to find out what was happening and get us out of there. Of course, it was funny to watch security grab a copy of the book and start thumbing through it and really strain themselves to keep themselves from smiling.
So let's talk a little bit more about the book itself. One of the things that jumped out at me, if for people who are familiar, if you have kids, you're probably familiar with Goodnight Moon, the original book. The whole story takes place inside this room, and it's kind of an elaborate room. It's very garishly decorated. And I imagine that it was not too difficult to translate this room into some version of Trump's penthouse, maybe with his redecorated Oval Office.
We borrowed a lot of details straight from his penthouse. You know, the kind of innocence of the great green room that was in Goodnight Moon has now been kind of assaulted by Trump's terrible interior decorating style. There's gilded gold columns and you know, plenty of fake gold throughout the room.
And the issues that you touched on in the book are varied because there are so many of them. In fact, I was just thinking to myself, the news cycle is moving so fast. It's so fast paced that things that might have just happened a day or two ago feel like they happened a week or two ago. Things that happened the week before, we've just forgotten about. So you obviously had an enormous number of issues that you could have addressed in the book. How did you narrow down which ones to address?
It was a very difficult challenge. You know, it's twice as long as Goodnight Bush.
Really?
And we're only 2 years into this administration. And it was just incredible the amount of crises and disasters that this administration has been kind of foisting upon this country and the world. So we had a tough time finding the things that seemed to resonate and were the most important. And certainly, you know, in the week after the book went to print, there were 10 more. So we tried to cover as much as we could, but, you know, we know that this isn't just about what's in the book, but also about what people are doing out in the streets and trying to challenge this administration. So we hope that the book leads from people reading it at home in private to reading it together to actually going out and doing something in the real world to change the direction that we're headed.
One of my favorite lines was, "Good night, hole in the man-child's soul." I thought that was quite poetic. And I think, especially given the evangelical support for Trump, from a demographic that's supposed to underpin their actions through compassion, the hole in the soul of Trump, I thought was really beautifully described, but also illustrated. Tell us about the illustrations in this book.
Well, we, of course, wanted to evoke the kind of magical style of Goodnight Moon, but talk about these very serious things. And so I, as the illustrator, really studied the way that Clement Hurd, the illustrator, did the first book, but found a way to talk about things like the fact that our president seems to be just a profoundly empty and immature person. And in the book, I don't want to give too much away about the ending, but it seems like this hole will never be filled. And it might be all of us, if we don't do something about it, that sort of gets sucked into this emptiness that's inside of this one person. And so we wanted to talk about what was happening in the country, but also how we're at the mercy of what's really a kind of an incomplete human being that is driving us headlong into disaster.
And you can tell so much through both the combination of images and words. So, for example, in the page about Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, it says, "Good night, towels thrown at Puerto Rico." And the words on the paper towel roll are 100% racist disaster capitalism. So through that combination of words and imagery, you were able to tell so much. And of course, for people who might remember, this is all based on what it was that Trump was doing in Puerto Rico.
This was a part of the United States that was in desperate need of humanitarian aid. And he thought it would be cute to just show up and throw paper towels at people, which of course is deeply offensive, and then compliment himself at how excellent his response was, saying, you know, that only 17 people perished. And of course, we know that that was false. And if you look at the paper towels illustration in the book, you know, we've put in a lot of details so that you don't just read it once through. You sort of go back and find all these other layers of meaning. Under disaster capitalism, it says number 2975. And that's actually the number of people that were estimated to have died. People look these things up. You know, it's meant to be a humorous book and sort of elevate people's spirits in a very difficult time. But there's a lot of serious things that we talk about at the same time.
Good Night, Child Held in Cage was particularly powerful as well. Of course, referring to the harsh anti-immigrant policies that Trump has led and pushed. And Good Night, Kids Gunned Down at School as well. These assaults that Trump has led against children, I assume you really wanted to highlight the irony of bringing that up in a parody of a children's book.
Yes, absolutely. And though we didn't create the book for children, I think we created it because we care about children and we care about our children's future. You know, I wouldn't just hand this book to children the way you might do with Goodnight Moon, but we found that a lot of parents have actually found the book really useful to them to sit down with their children and to talk about what's happening in the world right now. You know, children, they're aware. They're like sponges. They know that a lot of things are going wrong right now. And this book has provided a lot of parents a sort of a gentler way to sit down and have those serious conversations about what's happening. So in that sense, it really is a children's book. And we're hoping that people find it meaningful to them and a way to have those more difficult conversations.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
Member Devin Hein Nunez insists that the House Intelligence Committee's investigation of Boris Badenov and Natasha Petal will be conducted with sobriety and integrity, despite reports that 17 intelligence agencies recorded communications between himself and President Thump about how to assist the two Nogudniks with their plan to assassinate Moose and Squirrel. It is widely reported that some intelligence agencies leaked these communications to WikiFreaks in hopes of restoring the Flinton dynasty and its global influence-peddling Flinton Foundation. At press time, WikiFreaks CEO Julie N. Orange still refused to comment. Vladimir Putin, however, said that if he had wanted to influence the U.S. election, he simply would have donated to the Clinton Foundation himself. Senate Select Intelligence Committee member Dianne Feinlein is reported to have warned that Boris Benetash's strategy may be vastly more insidious than the assassination of Moose and Squirrel. They may be meeting with Green Party subversives to cause the repugnant and Democratic parties to collide like protons and antiprotons, mutually annihilating one another as antimatter, never to return.
Attention deficit disorder. I have surplus attention capacity syndrome.
She's gonna play, never what to say.
music is from the Gracie and Rachel Music CD. And now, back to our story.
As the Berkeley mock city mayor in 1999, I lobbied to get President Clinton to grant a pardon for Patty Hearst.
Who is Patty Hearst?
Patty Hearst was the daughter of a billionaire oligarch. She changed her name to Tanya when she was abducted from her Berkeley apartment, thrown into the trunk of a car, and forced to join the Symbiosis Liberation Army, a precursor to ISIS. She got infected with Stockholm Syndrome, sympathized with her abductors, and robbed the Hibernia Bank. The SLA were all killed, but Patty Tanya Hearst escaped, was caught, sent to prison, married her prison guard, and was pardoned instead of Leonard Peltier by the president.
Is that true?
Pardon me?
Tanya was a comic book revolutionary in the Symbionese Liberation Army. It was a constructed reality made for reality TV show on the nightly news programs. Look deeply into the all-seeing security camera pictures. She is wearing a beret with high-powered assault rifle aimed at the bank clerks. Why, of course, John Waters would later put Patty Hearst in his movies.
Who wrote the screenplay for those?
Was it all staged?
Had to be John Waters. Cast Patty Hearst in Serial Mom.
What is your point?
Think about it. Why would John Waters cast Patty Hearst in Serial Mom?
For 200 points, give a confusing answer to this question. Why did John Waters cast Patty Hearst in Serial Mom?
Oh, I should know this.
Repeat the question.
Why did John Waters cast Patty Hearst in Serial Mom?
Dude, she had name recognition.
Wrong.
Because Serial Mom is code for something else?
Nope, wronger.
Because Patty Hearst was an experienced actor.
We have a winner.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Do you want to watch it now?
She had experience acting for the camera.
Patty Hearst was great in Serial Mom. John Waters, if you are listening, consider me for the sequel, Mr. Serial Mom.
Patty Hearst was a crisis actor, and you know it.
Serial Mom was box office flop, so no sequel. The narrative was unbelievable. Billionaire bank robbers don't use guns to rob banks. They repeal the Glass-Steagall Act. No jail time.
Why would she hook up with revolutionaries? And where are they now?
Dead.
Ah, the astral plane is overcrowded with dead crisis actors. They always die in the shootouts at the end. Dead shooters answer no questions.
It's okay to let your heart race, heart race. Yeah, it's okay to let your heart race, heart race. wish this, was that your heart rate, heart rate?
Testosterone patch, and I've been using the nicotine patch, and one day we got our patches mixed up, and he put on my nicotine patch and he runs around the house bitching and eating everything. I put on the testosterone patch. I got a raise, a company car, a corner office, and I slept with the neighbor lady. But
analog broadcast radio doesn't leave a digital footprint. It can't target my constituents. What's it good for?
It saves lives, dude.
That's hearsay. My science advisor from the astral plane, Madame Blavatsky, told me in a dream that something bad is about to happen.
Dude, I gotta say, I don't believe anything you're talking about.
How do you spell your last name?
D-U-D-E.
I'm making a citizen's arrest.
Hands up, Mr. Dude.
My arm. Back off.
Robin, move it over. Come on.
Stop it. This is a non-violent program.
Hey, cut to the commercial. Cut to the commercial.
We don't have commercials.
Cut to the archive.
Welcome to
From the third ring of Saturn.
The gods are everywhere.
Listeners can post TwitWit at hashtag TwitWit Radio.
Well, eventually, all celebrities will be brain-enhanced clone bots.
Pick up the lone bone. That is my why. The what? The way of how. Rare area. The actual show, invisible sight. The lone drone is the only clone to own. Can you roll with that?
And now, back to our story. Caller on line three.
Go ahead, caller. Do you have a question for Lil Dwayne?
I'm anonymous, president of the Lil Dwayne fan club. Lil Dwayne is a god. I'm calling because I was promised cash money to be the president of the Lil Dwayne fan club. I want my money. The check bounced. That's a violation of my trust. I'm warning you. If I don't get paid, I will expose you. I know what's really going on. I will tell everybody the truth. Lil Wayne being a clone of his twin brother, Lil Dwayne. Lil Dwayne writes all the songs about Lil Wayne. Lil Wayne doesn't even exist. He's just a clone of Lil Dwayne. World has been fooled by mass hip-hop gnosis to confuse the fans, and nobody can figure out what's happening. Why do we see police gang violence in all the videos? God Bless America was produced by the Pentagon Film Office. I want my money, pay me now, or I will tell the world everything I know about the military entertainment state, infiltration of the music industry, and the chaos thing, because when it comes to...
Hello, caller? Caller, are you there?
The line is dead.
The military entertainment state doesn't mess around.
I was afraid this would happen.
We are at war with the universe. The sky is falling, and the only thing that can save us now, sensitivity and compassion. But I know one thing's for sure. Yeah, some say tragedy's hard to get over, but sometimes that tragedy means it's over. Soldier from the Academy League of Rollers, I deny being down, though they seem to hold us. My shoulders are strong, I prove them wrong. I ain't doing nothing but moving on. Let the truth be known, and they talk that freedom matters, and didn't even leave a ladder. Damn.
I work at the corner store, and we all got problems, problems. We ain't gonna fight alone. No one can save us now. How you feel? You're not alone. We're all just jealous, jealous. We don't reach for the sky no more. We just can't overflow.
Hope isn't home. Fate's not around. The luck's all gone. Don't ask me what's wrong. Ask me what's right. And I'ma tell you what's life. And did you know I lost everything? But I ain't the only one. First came the hurricane, then the morning sun. Excuse me if I'm on one. And don't trip if I light one. I walk a tight one. They try to tell me keep my eyes open. My whole city underwater. Some people still floating. And they wonder why black people still voting. Cause your president's still choking. Take away the football team, the basketball team. Now all you got is me to represent New Orleans. No governor, no help from the mayor. Just a steady beating heart and then a wish and a prayer. Let's pray. Come on, right now we just riding on love. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And if you come from under that water, then there's fresh air. Just breathe, baby. God's got a blessing to spare. Yes, I know the process has so much stress, but it's the progress that feels the best. See, I came from the project straight to success. And you're next, so try. They can't steal your pride, it's inside. Then they find it and keep on grinding. Cause in every dark cloud, there's a silver lining. I know. Right now, we just riding on love. Shining in the dark. We ain't trying to do nothing. Born right here in the USA. But due to tragedy, looked on by the whole world as a refugee. So accept my emotion. Do not take it as an offensive gesture. It's just the epitome of my soul. And I must be me. We got spirit, y'all. Yeah. They don't want us to see, but we already know.
The voice is Garrett Eaton. I'm Kid Berkeley, sitting in for Berkeley Kid, who returns next week. The category is Mass Hip Hypnosis. For 100 points, give a misleading answer to this question. If not, what? Where? If not, when?
Disorder.
Go ahead.
For security purposes, use misleading metaphors and encrypted small talk for the duration of the program.
Point of disinformation.
State your name and disorientation.
I'm anonymous.
Who isn't anonymous?
That is so stupid.
I feel the presence of a ghost. What's going on?
What's going on? I am the ghost of hip hypnosis. The police confiscated my car syrup. Drake owes me big time. That was my beat. I am the source. I am a river of burnt toast. I saw a butterfly in hell today. Am I going to jail today? God bless America. It's all going on. And when I find out about it, it's going to go on there too. Can you guess who I am without knowing my name? Then okay, you have to pay my fee.
Si vas al baile, baila conmigo. Si vas al carnaval, quiero ir contigo. Si vas a donde quiera, no me quedo atrás, porque quiero amarte más y más.
¿Para dónde vas,
muchacha?
¿Para dónde vas?
Oye, mujer.
¿Para dónde vas?
Oye.
¿Para dónde vas? ¿Dónde vas?
Hey.
al carnaval, quiero ir contigo. Si vas a donde quiera, no me quedo atrás, porque quiero amarte más y más. Dime,
¿para dónde vas,
muchacha?
¿Para dónde vas,
linda mujer?
¿Para dónde vas?
Oye,
¿para dónde vas? ¿Dónde vas? ¿Para dónde vas?
Oye, hoy,
¿para dónde vas?
La, 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 la.
¿Para dónde vas?
¿Por qué no me dices?
¿Para dónde vas? ¿Dónde vas? ¿Dónde vas? ¿Dónde vas?
This is the Berkeley Signal.
Where are you going? Donald, are there good news?
It's time again for Donald
Trump.
Theater. No one knows what is up or down.
Black
or white.
Legal
or
impeachable.
Everything is make believe in Donald
Trump.
Theater. So let's
pull the curtain
back.
We are controlling transmission. If we wish to make it louder, we will bring up the volume. We can change the focus to a soft blur.
You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into...
The things that this show has called him, this approach is, I guess it's kind of like we're living in the Twilight Zone.
Russia had nothing to do with this episode.
Truth isn't truth.
It's worth remembering that when 2018 began, we didn't know anything about illegal hush payments to porn stars, a secret resistor inside the Trump administration, or the fact that Rudy Giuliani always looks like he just sat on a box of thumbtacks. When the year began, Republicans controlled all three branches of government, and they were celebrating the passage of a corporate tax cut that lined the pockets of millionaires. And to take a victory lap at the time, Trump turned to his creepiest aide, senior advisor Stephen Miller.
You're right.
And Miller decided to go on TV and make the president look good, A, by comparison, and B, by calling him a genius.
On the campaign, I had the chance to travel all across the country with the president, and I saw a man who was a political genius. The reality is the president is a political genius. Of all these so-called political geniuses in Washington, whether it be at the big lobbying firms or
the only
many
person
of the
who's called himself a genius
Congress,
in the last week is the president, but
which happens to be a true statement.
And yet, in the almost 12 months since that comment, Trump has rambled at length about how people in Finland rake the floors of the forest. Left an umbrella outside when he couldn't figure out how to close it, got on Air Force One with toilet paper stuck to his shoe, and said this about a hurricane.
They haven't seen anything like what's coming at us in 25, 30 years, maybe ever. It's tremendously big and tremendously wet.
You know, the president is heading home tomorrow. He's off to Florida for 16 days.
Here's fun. Coincidentally, Richard Nixon went to Mar-a-Lago a month before he resigned the presidency. Oh, history, please repeat yourself. We did our part by not learning from you.
Is the president allowed to go away for 16 days? That's like five Scaramucci's worth of days. That's a lot of them. Tomorrow morning, Mike Pence will be checked into a kennel, and the president will jet to Mar-a-Lago, his private club, where Trump will once again host his annual New Year's Eve party. 2 years ago, you know, he charged guests to this party $575 a head to come. Then last year, it went up to $750 a head. This year, he's charging $1,000 a head. $1,000 to ring in the new year with these two party animals. That seemed like fun. The whole Trump family will be there. I wonder if he makes them pay to come to the party. Ivanka gets in free, everyone else full price. But it's a special holiday for the Trumps this year. And this could be the last Christmas Don Jr. will be able to spend with his dad without being separated by a glass partition. So Trump is leaving Washington, D.C. an absolute mess.
Now, when Trump gets back, he'll have a new chief of staff, budget director and chef from the pizza box, Mick Mulvaney. Mulvaney's predecessor, General John Kelly, tried to rein in Trump. But according to Politico, Mulvaney doesn't plan to try. I am honored to be the new zookeeper as my first official act. Unlock all the cages. Let's get the lions high and rub steak sauce on the penguins. Sources. I go for some penguin. Sources close to Mulvaney say he intends to give Trump more leeway to act as he chooses, a recognition that trying to control Trump is a futile approach. So, I'd like to point out that what we've seen in the last year and a half is Trump being controlled. What's he going to be like now? I was wrong. There are not fine people on both sides. White power. I'm going to tweet out the nuclear launch codes. I love Putin. I'll collude with anything that moves. Let the pee-pee rain. But we know one person who is going to be furloughed, regardless of whether the government stays open or not. And it's Secretary of Defense Jim Mad Dog Mattis. Because this afternoon, not that long ago, Mattis retired as defense secretary. Yeah, listen to that reaction. Kind of scary when everyone says, oh, there goes the voice of reason. Mad Dog. Mattis. Oh, no. Mattis took a shot at Trump on his way out, saying in his resignation letter to the president, you have the right to have a secretary of defense whose views are better aligned with yours. Yes, perhaps a feral child snarling at those who dare approach his pile of rotting food scrap. Point is, there's good news for the military and their families, because earlier today, the Trump administration announced plans to pull U.S. troops out of Syria immediately. This is great news for these families. And Trump explained the reason for his decision in his historic tweet. We have defeated ISIS in Syria. My only reason for being there during the Trump presidency. But after the Trump presidency, I might head over there because I'll be on the run from the law and there will be no troops to find me. But, and I know this might shock you, what the president said may not be true. First of all, his tweet came as a bit of a surprise to, the Pentagon? Because according to the Defense Department, the number of ISIS members in Syria and Iraq could be as high as 30,000. And right now, allied troops are on the cusp of capturing the last major town held by ISIS east of the Euphrates. All right, troops, this is what we trained for. We're going to go over there. We're going to end this thing, all right? I want you in full battle rattle when we cross that wire. Hold on, I'm getting a tweet. Hold on one second. Forget what I said. Let's go. Come on, back to the base. Which way's the base? Anybody know where the base? Of course, with a situation as complex and as dangerous as the Syrian civil war, who knows if this is the right move for America, but we know it's the right move for Russia because Russia's also got troops there backing the Assad regime. And today, Russian officials expressed satisfaction with Trump's decision. But a Pentagon official asked Jake Tapper, so when does Russia announce their victory? Oh, that's easy. It was November 8th, 2016.
Trump is currently dealing with a truly stunning number of criminal probes. Just to name a few, his White House is being investigated by the special counsel, his inaugural committee is being investigated for allegedly misspending donations, and his business is being investigated for hiding hush payments to cover up affairs. Not even Trump's doctor has ever examined him this closely. Then yesterday, the president was dealt another blow when his personal charity, the Trump Foundation, was forced to shut down after prosecutors effectively said it acted as a slush fund for Trump's personal spending.
President Trump's charitable foundation has agreed to shut down amid an ongoing investigation into its finances. In a statement, the Attorney General Barbara Underwood said, quote, our petition detailed a shocking pattern of illegality involving the Trump Foundation, including unlawful coordination with the Trump presidential campaign, repeated and willful self-dealing, and much more. This amounted to the Trump Foundation functioning as little more than a checkbook to serve Mr. Trump's business and political interests.
The Attorney General also alleging Trump used charity money to settle personal lawsuits.
So Trump used his charity to pay for lawsuits, which then prompted a lawsuit that ended the charity. At this point, he's going to have to start a new charity to pay for the lawsuit over the old charity. They can call it, I don't know, March of Crimes. He's going to do a 5K walk, but it's just going to be him asking for $5,000 so he can walk.
These lawyer fees are piling up. Could you do 6K?
And, of course, as you might remember, it was reported that Trump used his charity to buy two portraits of himself. Trump used his charity to treat himself like a Make-A-Wish kid. I got a portrait of myself, I got to ride in a helicopter, and I got to meet Grimace. And then, of course, Trump's campaign and his administration are dealing with the Russia investigation. Yesterday, his ex-National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn, appeared in court after pleading guilty to lying to the FBI about his contacts with Russians. Flynn's lawyers initially tried to argue that the FBI tricked him. Then they tried to take that argument back, and in response, the judge got super pissed.
The judge then laid into Michael Flynn, noting that making false statements to the FBI while he was National Security Advisor sitting there in the White House was a, quote, very serious offense. He then continued, quote, I'm not hiding my disgust, my disdain for this criminal offense. Arguably, you sold your country out.
Well, I'm no legal expert, but it's not good when a judge says you sold your country out at the sentencing hearing. It would be weird if Flynn didn't get a harsh sentence after that. You debased the White House and betrayed your country, and you're going free! Merry Christmas! Flynn was obviously worried as well and agreed with the judge's suggestion to delay sentencing until next year. Now, Flynn might at this point be hoping for a pardon from Trump. Flynn's botched court appearance is a reminder that this administration is full of people who are nefarious creeps, but also bumbling doofuses at the same time. Just take Trump's threat to shut down the government. Trump wanted $5 billion for a pointless border wall to enforce his racist immigration policies, but he was too incompetent to figure out how to get it. Last week, for example, he started out his Oval Office meeting with Democrats by saying it would be their fault if there was a government shutdown. And by the end of the same meeting, he did a complete 180 and said it would be his fault if there was a government shutdown.
You should not have a Trump shutdown. You have them at the White House.
You said Trump shutdown.
You have the White House. You have the Senate.
We shouldn't shut down the government over a dispute. And you want to shut it down. You keep talking about it.
The last time, Chuck, you shut it down.
No.
And then you opened it up very quickly.
20 times.
I don't want to do what you did.
You've said
it. Okay, you want to put that
on my... You said it.
I'll take it.
Okay, good.
You know what I'll say? Yes. If we don't get what we want, I will shut down the government.
Okay,
absolutely.
Fair enough.
And
we
I am
disagree.
Proud, and I'll
we
tell
disagree.
You what, I am proud to shut down the government for border security, Chuck.
Amazing. He started the meeting by calling it a Pelosi shutdown and ended it by saying it's my shutdown. Can you imagine if he ever does get arrested? I'm not guilty. Yes, you are. Okay, great. I want to go to jail.
Oh, good news. Here's something I did not think I'd be saying today. The government still exists. Because this afternoon, Mitch McConnell and Nancy Pelosi agreed to a bill that would fund the government through February 8th, just in time for Valentine's Day. They already have a plan to furlough government employees with candy hearts. You're the one who's out of a job. But here's the key thing. There is no funding for Trump's wall. Yes. Nothing. You know what that means? You know what that means? The Republicans blinked. Trump's not going to be happy about the wall, and he was already frustrated, tweeting,
the Democrats are saying loud and clear that they do not want to build a concrete wall, but we are not building a concrete wall. We are building artistically designed steel slats so that you can easily see through it.
Oh, it's artistically designed. That's different. I'm seeing an open concept steel slat, you know, to improve flow for parties, maybe add a 2,000-mile granite countertop. I mean, after all, what is the border wall but America's immigration backsplash? Now, where did Democrats get the foolish idea that the wall was going to be made of concrete?
I'll tell you what it's going to be made of. It's going to be made of hardened concrete.
Unlike Trump's promises, which are made of soft-serve bullcrap.
He caused quite a thing today. He announced today he's not going to sign a resolution to fund the government. This is a deal that was crafted by Republicans. They thought he was going to sign it. He surprised them and said, I'm not signing it unless I get the $5 billion I want for my border wall. If he doesn't get that money, which he won't, tomorrow night at midnight, the government will shut down, which means hundreds of thousands of workers won't get paid. Basically, Trump is taking paychecks from federal employees at Christmas time to punish Congress for not paying for a wall he swore 500 times Mexico would be paying for. So, Feliz Navidad, everyone. But
you think a political genius could at least figure out a way to deliver on the one thing he repeatedly told his supporters he would absolutely do, and that's build the wall. And yet today, Trump threatened the very real possibility of a government shutdown because he didn't get any money for the wall. In fact, it's finally starting to dawn on his supporters that the wall is never going to happen, and they are very upset about it.
Democrats are going to win on this. There will be no money for the president and his wall this time.
Not a penny. Forget wall. Think border security.
I think that not funding the wall is going to go down as one of the worst things to have happened to this administration. Forget Mueller. The wall has to be built. And this was a scandal that it hasn't been built.
Well, it's very sad. We needed the wall.
That's a real fight, and I don't know that he minds dragging it out for a while.
Okay. Is it something
so
he just
get a
needs
a series of 2-week agreements?
Is it something he just needs to give up on, though?
Wow, man, they're talking about the wall like they just lost a pet. Trump's going to have a special chat with the Fox and Friends. Mr. Trump, where'd the wall go?
It went to a farm upstate. To live with all the other walls.
Because he knows he's never going to get any money for his wall. Trump has been lying and claiming he's already building it just by putting up some fencing with existing money. But now supporters are starting to figure out that's also a lie. Here's Trump lying about the wall, followed by a very confused Laura Ingraham trying to figure out what he means.
A lot of wall has been built. We don't talk about that, but we might as well start because it's being built right now. Big sections of wall. And we will continue that.
I must have missed the wall being built. What wall? Where's it being built, Tom?
Well, I think what it means, you're upgrading certain parts of the
wall. That's not a wall. Stop saying it's a wall. There's no wall. If you want a wall, say, we don't have the wall. And I know it's bad because he made the promise, but they're not building the wall.
Wow. She went through all 5 stages of grief in 5 seconds. It's like watching someone realize they're in the Matrix in real time. This isn't real! None of this is real! So today, Trump, the political genius, said at the last minute he would not sign a deal to keep the government open. And in response, outgoing House Speaker Paul Ryan scrambled to find a way to get him money for his wall, which is a fitting end to Paul Ryan's career. Ryan has spent all year loyally serving Trump and ignoring his many abuses of power, even openly admitting he doesn't pay attention to Trump's scandals.
Mark Sanford yesterday said that, speaking on the Stormy Daniels story, that he said the allegations of hush money are a big deal. I guess first question is, do you agree with that characterization?
I haven't put a second of thought into this. It's just not on my radar screen.
This must bother you, Access Hollywood, Stormy Daniels, Karen McDougal. At a certain point, it must be embarrassing.
Well, look, I didn't even read the article.
Is it appropriate, in your view, for the White House to invoke executive privilege and deny Steve?
I'm not familiar with exactly what happened yesterday. I've been a little busy with some other tasks.
Man, Paul Ryan might be a bad House Speaker, but he'd be a great roommate. Hey, Paul, my friends are coming over to watch a UFC fight, and then my punk band's going to practice. That's cool. I'll be busy with other tasks. Yesterday, in his farewell address, Ryan decried what he called our broken politics. But Ryan is the one who spent 2 years ignoring Trump's many scandals and actively praising Trump in truly absurd ways, like when the GOP passed their corporate tax cut.
Something this big, something this generational, something this profound could not have been done without exquisite presidential leadership.
I'm sorry, did you just use the word exquisite to describe Donald Trump? You're talking about him like he's an art installation at the Guggenheim. He's not exactly a Picasso. I mean, look at him. If he looks like anything, he looks like he was painted by Edward Munch. Although, you know what? He'd fit right in that Salvador Dali painting with all those melting clocks. Watching Ryan frantically try to scrape together money for Trump's border wall is a fitting way for his career to end. Ryan used high-minded rhetoric about the importance of our institutions while Trump degraded those institutions. For example, Ryan had nothing to say when President's lawyer Rudy Giuliani went on TV and literally said that truth isn't truth.
When you tell me that, you know, he should testify because he's going to tell the truth and he shouldn't worry, well, that's so silly because it's somebody's version of the truth, not the truth. He didn't have a conversation.
Truth is truth. I don't mean to go like.
It isn't truth. Truth isn't truth. The President of the United States says, I didn't.
Truth isn't truth. Mr. Mayor, do you realize what this is going to become a bad meme.
Don't do this to me.
In every interview, Rudy sounds like a grandpa whose adult children just put him in a nursing home. Don't do this to me. I can live on my own. Just give me a stair lift.
Here's the twist. The twist is the president might not need Mexico or Congress to pay for the wall at all because there are some very dopey people ready to pay for it themselves. So this Trump supporter, a guy named Brian Colfage, started a GoFundMe campaign to raise $1 billion for the wall. He launched it on Sunday.
It's already up to almost $9 million. People, this is what people do with their disposable income when they don't have loans from college to pay off. Donating money for a wall that will never exist, it's like starting a college fund for Harry Potter. A more useful thing to do with your money would be to go outside and feed it to a bird. But you do have to admire the sacrifice they're making. I mean, a lot of these people are dipping into their meth money for this. And on top of all that, Trump's Secretary of Defense, General Jim Mattis, surprised everyone and resigned today. I guess the rumor is he disagreed with Trump's decision to withdraw troops from Syria. And as a result of that, he's now the 13th member of Trump's cabinet to depart in 20 months. There are only 24 people in the cabinet, by the way. That includes the vice president, who can't leave. Eventually, Ben Carson is going to be the only one left eventually, if they can find him. Has anyone seen him this year? Hi, I'm Jimmy Kimmel. I hope you enjoyed that video. Hit subscribe and all your dreams will come true, assuming your dreams are to watch more YouTube videos.
We learned recently that Trump and his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, had lied about plans to build a Trump Tower in Moscow during the 2016 campaign. After insisting that he never had any business deals in Russia, Trump went back on all that and admitted he did try to build a Trump Tower in Moscow, but insisted it wasn't that big a deal.
It was during the early part of 16, and I guess even before that. It lasted a short period of time. I didn't do the project. I decided not to do the project, so I didn't do it. So we're not talking about doing a project. We're talking about not doing a project. I decided ultimately not to do it. There would have been nothing wrong if I did do it. If I did do it, there would have been nothing wrong. That was a project that we didn't do. I didn't do. It was just reported very well by Catherine Herridge, who's a terrific reporter on Fox. She talks about a letter that he signed. I don't even remember it. And it specifically talks about this deal.
Trump only knows three words, and then when he runs out, he starts drawing invisible squares with his hands. I guess you could call him a French meme. The Trump Tower project was apparently so serious that there was actually an official letter of intent signaling that Trump wanted to go forward with it. Now, you heard Trump there say he didn't really know anything about that letter, and on top of that, Rudy insisted the letter wasn't a big deal for one important reason. He told CNN there was a letter of intent to go forward, but no one signed it. Oh, come on, Rudy, that's your excuse? No one signed it? What's next? He tried to mail it, but he doesn't know Putin's address. Well, you will never guess what happened. This week, we found out that Rudy was either lying or very wrong when he said no one signed the letter.
This is the letter of intent for the proposed Trump Tower Moscow, all right? It is signed by Donald J. Trump. It's a lot of pages, man, with a lot of detail about what they wanted and how they wanted it and how he'd be paid. And there's his signature, okay?
So Trump lied about the letter, too. Mr. President, let me put this in a way you'll understand. You went on TV and said you didn't sign the letter, but now the feds might bust down your door and put you in a cell, and then we'll be stuck with President Mike Pence. So, how did Rudy explain the fact that Trump's signature actually does appear on the letter? He said he was confused.
Rudy Giuliani is commenting to our Dana Bash, a new comment, saying that he was wrong if he said that the president didn't sign this letter. He said, I haven't seen the quote, but I probably meant to say that there was never a deal, much less a signed one. So some very, very confusing statements from Rudy Giuliani. You don't want a lawyer, especially one working for the president of the United States, who is going to say two things completely opposite of one another.
You wouldn't, but that's exactly the kind of lawyer Donald Trump wants. He thinks he's psyching everyone out by putting a crazy person on TV. Trump watched Lethal Weapon and thought, I want a lawyer like that. Every Rudy interview basically goes like this.
Joining me now is the president's attorney.
Yeah, you want to see crazy?
Trump is in serious legal jeopardy just as Democrats prepare to take over the House, and he's hoping he can salvage his presidency by threatening a shutdown over his wall. I'm not saying he's scared, but his pants are
tremendously wet.
This is the Berkeley Signal.